lucky to be joined here today by Vanir Wisdom. Vanir, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Vanir is one of the senior editors at The Lancet, and we chatted a couple of weeks ago about something completely unrelated, and we talked then for 2 seconds about global health. I demonstrated my lack of knowledge very quickly about the global cancer footprint, and I thought it'd be terrific if you joined us today and just talk in broad terms about, you know, from a cancer perspective, where the main challenges lie. Brian and I do a lot of podcasts on drug development, but we're not working too much on some of the bigger challenges from a global perspective. What are the big 3 or 4 challenges we face over the next decade globally?
Thanks, Tom and Brian. It's very, very happy to join this podcast today. Right. Global health, I think, in oncology, it's a very new discipline. And at The Lancet, we really focus a lot on, studies looking at ways of bringing benefits to the patients globally. Because at the end of the day, there's not much of a point of producing more checkpoint inhibitors or more drugs to, you know, that are going to benefit the few and not the many. So the challenges are really, I think the biggest challenge is closing cancer disparities, cancer inequities, in particular because we know all the projected estimated of the new cancer cases are going to be predominantly affect low and middle income countries where less research is done and where less resources are available. So the challenges are how to prepare those countries to tackle the burden of cancer that is coming. And we see a lot of studies on new therapeutics, normally drugs, but we see very little, say, cancer screening trials. There has never been, take the example, prostate cancer. There has never been a cancer trial looking at PSA population-based study in low and middle-income countries. We don't know how effective it is. Yet, prostate cancer is going to be increasing dramatically in black men in the coming decade. So maybe resetting the priorities is a major problem to redirect funding, redirect efforts so that the countries where the burden is the highest can also benefit from all the knowledge we have. We have so many resources. We're better equipped now than we were a decade ago. And yet, if you look at, you know, mortality, cancer mortality globally, there are more people dying of cancer now than they were a decade ago. And this is because, of course, people live longer, people are more exposed to risk factors. But it's also because we have not been making the best use of the resources we have.
Vanir, how do we, if I could just interrupt, how do we do that practically, right? I mean, you know, obviously, certainly in the U.S., a lot of the drug development is pharmaceutical industry funded, not all of it, but a chunk of it. Interest in screening trials, which are very hard to do. It's not my expertise, but I think very hard to do and hard to show definitive differences that impact practice, aren't about a drug that's going to make money. And conducting those trials or any trials in third world countries is exceedingly difficult for probably 100 reasons, right? So how, what would be the first steps to trying to tackle that problem? I mean, I totally agree. I think everyone would agree. I'm just not sure how to get there.
I would say the answer is collaborative research. We want collaborative research where, you know, the major research funders can promote research where we in high income countries can look at colleagues in low and middle income countries as partners that can tackle a disease together with us. and that can go in, that can bring the insight of the specific context where they live, so that, you know, we can produce context-specific, context-sensitive guidelines that can adjust what we've seen it's working in high-income countries. Probably it will work in low- and middle-income countries, but we need more participation of researchers and the communities of those countries where this is not available. They might not have the funding, or they might not have access to the knowledge that might be available in high-income countries. So I would say the first step is collaborative research. So, and certainly there's a lot of learnings for researchers and communities in high-income countries to learn from them as well. So being finding partners in a way that we're not doing helicopter research. We don't want to go there, collect samples and come back. We want to be, I think, successful. We want to create more opportunities of a collaborative research where high-income countries participate side by side as partners from the low- and middle-income countries.
Funny, I've only been in a helicopter once, and it wasn't a very pleasant experience, to be honest. My concern around that approach that you've talked about is the infrastructure required to do clinical trials is becoming more complicated, and the governance around clinical trials, the levels are becoming higher and higher. I'm a great supporter of that. I think that research performed at a low level at times can give complex signals. And sometimes even cooperative group research in the US and the UK is criticized because we lose patients to follow up, or we didn't address the adverse events properly. If we're struggling with investigator-initiated research in the UK and in the US, how can we transfer, how are we going to be able to get high-quality research in lower-income countries where the research is so important?
I would say perhaps we need to readjust the bar here. And often, the most of the trials I often see at the Lancet, they look at what I would call very sophisticated drugs, very, you know, the requirements to set up the trial, to collect data, all those issues you just mentioned are quite hard to meet, as you said. But there are also, there have been some discussion around the potential of affordable, practice-changing, pragmatic trials where, you know, you look at simpler questions that might, that will inform policy in specific regions. And they don't have to be, a trial doesn't have to be sophisticated, neither the trial nor the drug, because sometimes it will be more productive, more useful for countries with low resources. If, for instance, we design non-inferiority trials that look at de-escalating treatments, or that looking at reproposing a drug that's already available. There are many proposals on how to implement pragmatic trials that would reduce, as you say, all the admin and practical aspect around it.
I think you hit on something. I think it's probably not the same exact type of trial that we can do, you know, in high income countries and low. I think the resources required to sort of plop our trial there are enormous in expertise. And frankly, we struggle to do that in high income countries, right? So one is reducing the burden of, you know, the data and regulatory and legal burden of doing trials, period, right? I would love to see that, because I think all of us struggle with the resources required to do even simple trials. And then the second, maybe as you say, is to realize that we may just have to ask different questions in low income countries and do pragmatic trials. And actually at Vanderbilt, they've done some pragmatic trials of, you know, normal saline versus lactated ringers in ER patients, sort of just where the randomization is computer. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily the most sophisticated, but you can do many, many patients and ask a really important question without that huge burden of infrastructure.
Completely, because the priorities are different. And often trials are, you know, dominated by interests of the pharmaceutical industry. And that those might not be aligned with the needs of the patients. So you say, you know, again, going back to low and middle income countries, if in Africa, most of the patients are diagnosed with late disease. So it seems like obvious the greatest need there is to, if palliative care services, how much research do we have in palliative care services or early diagnosis? Very little, right? So it's really like, changing the resetting the priorities to make sure the research that is done can benefit most of the patients around the world. And this might require different formats, different, more diverse type of trials that can be you know, integrated and feasible for the countries where it might have the most benefit.
I mean, what's going on from a global perspective in terms of cigarette smoking and easily reversible risks? Is that a battle that we're winning from a global perspective?
I mean, I think in the tobacco, you know, that's the only binding legal commitment that countries have signed up for is the tobacco agreement that WHO promoted, and it's been amazing. I think that's a very successful global health intervention. Still, it's not had been implemented as much as it should. I mean, the promises, and now it is legally binding, but still there is space for more improvement in the area of tobacco smoking. It worked though. I mean, in terms of smoking, as far as smoking goes as a risk factor, I think we controlled, that's the most successful example of a public health, global health intervention that we've done. Other have not been so successful. If you look at alcohol, sugar tax, the obesity problem that we could tackle with more physical activity, all those interventions, you hear lots of promises, but really empty of action around the countries. Some countries have adopted national cancer control plans, some haven't. And I think that's one way to go to promote and encourage countries to adopt a national cancer plan. And all these interventions should be part of it.
So, Vinya, it's going to cost money to do trials, right? Whether they're simple, pragmatic, and targeted or complex. So where does the money come from? Where can it come from? And really the interest, right? You have to have boots on the ground to run the trials there. I don't know that you can do it entirely remotely, although maybe in part. So where does that resource come from currently or maybe in an ideal state?
Look, I think we'll have to be looking at the collaborative, non-commercial collaborative research groups. I know, for instance, in the US, the NCI have a collaborative research group that funds some research within the scope of this type of innovation we're talking about. You have the ORTC in Europe, the Organization for Research and Treatment in Cancer. So we need more of this type of organizations that promote and provide the infrastructure, because they don't not only promote, but they provide the infrastructure that will be supporting the countries with lower resources. And that's by a change of specialized workforce, that's by providing advice, providing the material. There are different formats through which this collaboration has to might work. But I think we're talking about non-commercial collaborative groups, and they started existing, but we need more. We need more, and I think.
If we have a certain amount of those now, right, like you say, ERTC and others, do we need like 10 times the funding that we have now? Is it 2 times? I mean, I don't know. It's an estimate, obviously, but I'm just wondering, how far are we from adequate resources?
That's a good question. But you know what? I normally answer to that question. as much as asking how much that might cost to do, we also should be asking how much that might cost not to do, because the cost of inaction is also huge and could, right. You know, really the balance, I suspect, might work.
One is more tangible, one might be more intangible, but I'm just wondering if you controlled all the resources in the world, do we need 2x? Do we just need twice the funding? Or is it we need like 100 times the funding to actually make improvements?
I really don't have the answer for that question. I don't have the full picture of how many organizations are there. But regardless of the money... It's also a social, you know, apart from the cost effective, it's really a social responsibility. It's immoral to see these cancer inequities. And so we are celebrating with just World Cancer Day just around the corner. For the third year running, the theme of the World Cancer Day is Close the Cancer Gap. It seems not acceptable that inequalities persist and they are widening instead of closing when we have more knowledge, more resources, more technologies. It's paradoxical.
And Fanny, they're widening because richer countries are developing more quickly and the cancer plans in poorer countries are not being implemented. Why is that gap getting wider?
It's getting wider because the number of people, the incidence of cancers is increasing by changing in demographics and disease epidemiology, right? So that, I think, two big factors. People are living longer and are being more exposed to risk factors to cancer. And another element is the precision medicine has advanced, for instance, a lot. The treatment of cancers in the high-income countries or in the countries where that patient has access to it. So countries with resources, not only they have more access to the cutting edge and more quality care, but also those are the countries where the increase of cancers is less prominent. The other countries have the burden is increasing more prominently and they are behind the curve with the development.
My build-up question from that is, you know, humans are basically the same. We've done research for 20 years in high-income countries. Why just do no research in low-income countries but just adopt what we've learned already? Do we need to reinvent the wheel again and do all this research? Is it not better just investing that money in screening practices that we know work and that in early diagnostic practices that we know work and in high, you know, quality surgery centers? Why do the research? Why is it necessary? Don't we know enough to improve already? Is it not just a case of improving medical services? What role has research got to play?
My short answer is I don't think we know enough. Because what you've done in high-income countries was, for instance, research based on white male, white population. In the case, I'm thinking again of prostate cancer. Prostate cancer, one of the risks of prostate cancer is related with ethnicity. And we know we're going to find more black men than white men. But yet all the research only includes, you know, not only, but predominantly includes white men. So, and we really need research to be more diverse, to include people from other ethnicities, so that we can also understand, we need to understand, one, the biological differences in the, you know, in the efficacy of different drugs, but also the context-specific the context of where patients live, because not always a treatment that makes that will be feasible in a high-income country that will make sense will be well accepted in a low- and middle-income country for various reasons. And it might be, say that treatment is through surgery. in that country, patients will feel they have the stigma in those countries is not compared. It's very different with the stigma associated with cancer in high income countries. And they might feel uncomfortable that after surgery will be more visible that they had cancer, or after chemotherapy, they will be more visible. And you have to offer solutions that make it attractive for the patients to accept, not attractable, to make patients comfortable with the treatment. So I think there's a lot of adjustments that needs to be done. And I would call this implementation, the gap into implementation science of it might work, but not exactly in the same format as what we do in high-income countries. So filling in that gap with implementation science to adjust what we know it works in the populations where it has been studied, see what's the best fit for the populations where it has not been studied. I think we're missing that.
Which of the high-income countries, which of the low-income countries are setting the standard in terms of cancer treatment development, and which of the high-income countries are participating most in that journey?
This question, I don't know who I would say in low-middle-income countries is leading the way. Certainly, the awareness is raising. We have AAOTIC, the Association for Cancer in Africa, is being very, very, is leading, you know, the awareness, the education, the training of specialists. I'm not entirely sure which country is ahead of the curve. But unfortunately, I don't think there is an obvious one. In high-income countries, I would say, US and Europe, right? Those are the ones where we have more research done. We know those populations much better. We know the context and resources. So I don't know if you had the chance to see a Lancet commission we launched last year on women power and cancer. That commission was very eye-opening for how specific contexts really determine the behavior of people as patients. Because, say, in females, patriarchy, the power that women lack to make their own decisions, to even access information, it's really highly determinant of the care they are going to have. So we really need to make an effort to better understand the people that we're treating, because patients, before being patients, they are people, right? And they might be able to offer them care in a different way if we understand what are their concerns, where they're coming from, basically. If they are not even allowed to leave home because they have women have kids to look after, and they feel, there are a few patient stories included in the cancer, the commission on women power and cancer. And you hear women say, I delayed my surgery because my kids were going through their first exams at school and I wanted to be there next, to follow them. And there was no one else to do it. So she ended up having very late disease by the time she was treated because her priority were her kids. So this makes all difference on a day to day when I believe when a clinician sees a patient, understanding how can you in first place get that patient to be diagnosed earlier. All this, I think this all needs to be contextualized, and that's where it's the biggest difference came, I think,
I was going to ask a follow-up question, maybe my last question, and I think you just alluded to this, is how much of the gap that appears to be widening, which is depressing, is cultural, meaning the societies in which these cancers occur. Obviously, there's huge cultural overlay of who's leading the society, what are the cultures around participating in a clinical trial, or having experimental research or going to the doctor or not going to the doctor, like all the things you mentioned. I mean, those barriers seem even greater, right? Even greater to overcome than just access to drugs or trials.
Completely. I think one of the major issues is that, generally speaking, society still looks at cancer as a clinical problem. And until society, global health leaders, policymakers, until there is the understanding of cancer as a social problem, the barriers and challenges that society presents to patients are huge, and they really came in all sorts of formats. So to address cancer, we need to address, you know, systemic problems in society. Say the power dynamics is one when you talk about gender disparity, the stigma, the funding, it's the disruption, the burden of cancer, it goes so far beyond the clinical implications. And I think that's one thing I really try, as an oncology ambassador at The Lancet, that's one thing I really try to highlight. We're not talking about just the clinical disease. We're talking about the burden to the healthcare systems, to the, to the family of the patient, to the work where patients normally would belong, and now in terms of the economy also gets affected. It's so broad and really it's difficult. You're asking me, it's difficult to quantify, but the cost of inaction can only be really huge, because the implications are at various levels beyond clinical ones.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this has been fabulous. We need to, Brian and I need to go away and do some reading, and we need to come back to you at some point with some better questions. I think this is an area which we don't know enough about. My last question: when someone sends you a paper, not Brian or myself, when someone sends you a paper and it's coming from a low-income country, how do you benchmark that off a big randomized phase 3 from a pharmaceutical company that costs hundreds of millions of dollars? How do you make that work?
You know, for us, it's very important the impact that the research is going to have. So as far as the study has quality and having quality and it ticks all the boxes for what we call ethical and integrity, and a study that raises no integrity questions in terms of how the patients were recruited, etc. So we want to make sure ethically the study has been approved. We certainly will be very interested in publishing that study, because we will always look into areas that are neglected, and research in low and mid-income countries is certainly one of those. So
at The Lancet, do you prioritize those areas? I mean, do you have areas of priority, or is it, you know, the question I'm asking is it as difficult and is the bar as high for interesting work from developing countries as it is from interesting work from developed countries? I'm sure that's the wrong phrase. I think it's low and high income.
Look, I think the bar is not the same, because the needs of the patient are not the same. But what is the same is the quality of the work we're looking for and the impact that it might have. So, and depending also what the research question, for instance, often studies from low and middle income countries might find a home at the Lancet Global Health Journal. If the goal of the study is really, say, look into ways of making a drug available for a wider number of the population. If we're looking at a trial looking into a specific drug that is of a regional interest, then maybe it's more of the scope of a regional journal. And we also have regional, Lancet regional journals that look at studies of issues, health issues that are more relevant for the population that's been studied. But if it's a study that actually could inspire other researchers on the approach more so than the drug itself, sometimes it's the approach that was taken to the research that is the main key finding as the feasibility and what can achieve. Then probably it's a good study for the Lancet if the impact is going to be generalizable and transferable application, then it can certainly be a study for the Lancet.
Vinny, this is great. We appreciate your time today. We'd love to have you back to talk more about global health. As Tom said, we have a lot to learn about this. It's an underrepresented topic, and I think we all have a lot to learn, right, about how to extend the benefits. So we appreciate your time today.
Pleasure. Anytime.
All right. We'll see you again.
And,